Welcome to That Makes Total Sense, a podcast dedicated to exploring God's generosity and justice. I'm Alexis Busetti, a Christian aiming to ask good questions and encouraging you to do the same. Every one of us is wired by God to live out generosity and justice, but the how sometimes eludes us. That Makes Total Sense is a way for us to get together, posture ourselves as learners, and challenge one another to practice generosity and justice in a tangible way every day. Okay, so my guest for today, this was a cold call, Aaron. It happens sometimes. I'm so grateful when people respond as you did. And with enthusiasm and grace for my, you know, kind of novice position in this area. But I'm here today with Erin Weber Johnson, and she has co-edited a volume called Crisis and Care, Meditations on Faith and Philanthropy, which I think I haven't like said this out loud to many folks outside of the people who like live in my house or are on my text, you know, messages or go to my seminary. But I think by the time this show airs, I will be starting PhD program at Fuller Theological Seminary, and my research will be focusing on this thing that, Aaron, no one's ever heard of.
I know.
So anytime I say the term philanthropic redlining, which is going to be the main focus of our conversation today, I get a look like I am speaking a foreign language. So I don't really want to start there, though. So like, we'll put a pin in that.
Put a pin in it.
And first, I just want to ask you to kind of briefly introduce yourself, but also give us a little bit of your background in the faith and philanthropy spaces, because what I feel like I have observed, or maybe it's just kind of my take on it right now, my perception is probably a good way to put it, is this philanthropy feels kind of like this underground river. It's like this doesn't feel real obvious to a lot of folks, especially in faith spaces outside of kind of typical tithes and offerings, or maybe a building campaign here and there or something. Mm-hmm. But I think philanthropy ends up impacting way more of our everyday lives and organizations and things like that than we realize. So that just is my kind of early perception, but I would love to hear, again, just like a brief introduction of you, and then what, where have you spent time in these faith and philanthropy spaces?
Oh, yeah. It's so good to be here. And congratulations on your program.
Thanks, Erin.
I have to say, it did my heart so good to know that there was someone who is gathering resources and is going to be highlighting this really important topic in the conversation of philanthropy. I agree. Let me just first say, I believe that where money intersects with bodies, that's where we see systems of inequity, right? And so philanthropic redlining is one of those key intersections. All right, now that my thesis is out there, let me give a little background about who you're in the room with. Yes, my name is Erin Weber Johnson. I have spent my entire vocation serving the church in some capacity or another. I grew up evangelical. I found Jesus in the Episcopal Church in 2003. I have often seen my work in various fields, one of translating, one of saying, okay, what is the language that removes barriers and provides access to relationship and connection, right? With that in mind, I went to NYU and I got a master's in nonprofit management with a emphasis both on conflict negotiation and in fundraising, because I knew that I was feeling called to the church in a non-ordained way. And my experience of the church, those are two things that if there's going to be conflict, it's going to oftentimes come around money, right? I was recruited right out to work at the grants department at Trinity Wall Street, and then began cutting my teeth doing fundraising for a foundation in New York. Did all kinds of fundraising all across the U.S. for campaigns as small as 15,000 all the way up to 16 million. And that's where I've been for the last 20 years. But what I learned early on was that oftentimes the resources and the language that's used didn't always align. Like there were things that people were told they should believe or they should feel obligated to believe, and it didn't align with my real life experience. And I began to want to learn more. And so that it was there that I started taking more and more seminary courses and became deeply interested in what alternative economies might look like and what is it that are the parables that we read about are actually saying and pointing us to, et cetera, et cetera. It was then that I started to read and write and develop scholarship. Fast forward to 2018, where, no, 2016, where I was a plenary speaker. Imagine being at a plenary where I got up to speak and I was speaking about a different way to think about money and a different way for us to think about our resources. And then someone else got up to speak and they gave the exact same plenary speech. Whoops. That's kind of embarrassing. And Mika Vandersal and I looked at one another and we said, I didn't know there was someone else out there like us, similar to your calling me. Like, oh, someone else is interested in what I'm passionate about. This is
How
great.
fantastic.
At the very same time that I was meeting Mika, it was a bit of a spirit-led moment. I had also, for my denomination, we have what's called the College for Bishops. It provides training for our judicatory bodies. And I had developed an annual giving curriculum with some wonderful faculty. And I was what I like to do is I like to take data. I love data. And I was tired of people saying, you should believe this and you should believe that. And I wanted to say, hey, this is the data, and this is how we can show up pastorally for people. This is the language that we can use to translate the distance between their need and an exciting invitation that might answer their need, you know? So I really like to use these characteristics, generational characteristics, donor motivations, all those sorts of things. So I'm standing up there, Alexis, and it's a packed house, which is kind of intimidating. And Bishop Eugene Sutton, the retired Bishop of Maryland, stands up and he very graciously says to me, you know, this data that you were reporting on, and by the way, I was using 30 different data points, 30, including Pew, including like all of the places that you would go to. He says, this data is really going to be helpful for my congregations that are predominantly white. What do you have for congregations that are for color, for people that are color, that have color? And I said, huh? And then I did that thing that, you know, as a facilitator, you do where you're like, does anybody else have that data? I would love to know. If anybody else has it, let's all learn together, right? And no one, of course, had it. And then I did this thing, which I never do. But I said, you know what, Bishop Eugene, I'm going to get you that data because it's important. And I felt it. It was like this moment. I felt like God was talking to me, saying, get this man his data. Here's the issue. I spent the next year looking everywhere for the data. Now, let me say what that actually entails. When you look at most studies, 99.9% of the studies that come out about giving and all of its different forms, if you look to see the demographics, the best I've seen in terms of including people of color is somewhere between 4% and 5%.
Oh, wait, can we pause there
Yes.
for a minute? I am really, really glad you started here because it is, I mean, this was like the asterisks on my, you know, on my notes are, tell me about the missing data.
Where is it and why isn't it there?
Where is it and why isn't it there? Because this 4 to 5%.
That's right.
This is the most wild thing. I'm having a hard time fathoming it. So I don't have any additional question or comment or something. I'm just like pausing because folks won't be able to see my face when I'm like agape, like going, what is
I'm
this?
Laughing.
This is a huge deal, Erin.
I know, I'm laughing.
This is a huge deal.
This is exactly
deal.
My response. Like, first of all, how did I not know this? A, right? This was because I've been teaching to the data, using the data for all of my strategies at that point for 15 years, right? So I was incredulous. And then further, and this is where it becomes horrifying to me.
Already horrifying to me. So let's just...
Yeah. This is where it turned. Well, this turned from like laughing at my own ignorance, right?
Okay. Okay,
recognizing like the systemic evil that's
yes.
taking place here.
Yes. Okay.
Was I began to realize the impact of what happens when we are doing this. What ends up happening is that we people who are giving consultants, people who are looking at data, who are saying, who are doing the work of really wanting to contextualize and understand what's happening, we take this data and then we say, this is what you should know. This is the one way to do it. This is the right way to do it. Not knowing that there is a whole lot of diversity out there. There's a whole lot of giving characteristics. There's a whole lot of giving strategies that we're missing out. And we're not reflecting. We're not giving voice to that they're not showing up. They're not speaking their wisdom into. So.
I'm going to interrupt you again. I didn't warn you that I was going to interrupt quite this much. And
I wasn't planning on it
to be completely truthful. But
you interrupt. Go ahead.
This particular question was the one for me where I am going to have those. Okay. I need more. So when you're talking about, I just want to kind of hone in a little bit and be a little bit more specific about the data. What kind of giving is this data representing? So when you're talking about giving strategies, you're in the context of a Christian denomination. When you're talking about most of this data that you're seeing that is not representative of people of color, what kinds of giving is that representative? Does my question even make sense?
Yeah. Okay. So, and while you were looking for clarification, what I'm going to tell you is a long list.
Okay, like, great. Good.
It includes the language that we use, for example. So, did you know among Hmong congregations, there's not even a word, there's not even a concept of charitable giving. It's all in the context of family. So imagine among parish, I can give you right in my own judicatory body, going to their diocese training event to receive, you know, tips on how to increase their giving and being taught to in a literal, even though it's English, in a language that does not apply to their context with skills and strategies that don't apply.
Wow.
In Spanish, there's not a word for stewardship. They also have other words. The word stewardship implies ownership for quite a few. And for some, that it came up in a later study that we did, it implied colonialism.
Wow.
So
not the same thing. We're literally not even talking about the same. We're not even talking the same language.
Not
when we're
even.
Talking about these concepts. Wow.
No. And so church leaders, national leaders, regional leaders are teaching, you know, oh, these are the strategies. You show up with a pledge card. There are congregations for whom, why would you pledge if you're showing up for your family? You don't do that at Christmas time. You don't fill out a pledge card when you give each other gifts, right? Like, there was just not even a concept for what was happening. So there's also language that's harmful. For example, the word abundance. The word abundance is used a lot right now. It's used almost as, I would say, as a replacement to the word tithe, because tithe has had some emotional and spiritual trauma attached to it. So I think the word abundance was used by some to replace that. And for a number of communities, the word abundance is harmful. Who's abundance? How did they get abundance? I don't have the same access to abundance. You talk about abundant life as salvation, but I'm hungry. You know, like there's all sorts of different components there. And then there's also the delegitimization. There was a participant, surprise, surprise, I ended up doing research with a group of people, and I'm speaking to some of the results we learned. I had a participant who said, you know, our ice is cold, our water is wet. Why doesn't it show up in this data, right? And there's a delegitimization of what is happening and is happening well in communities of color,
yes,
because it doesn't, yes, show up in the data.
Yes, so, yes. Okay, thank you for letting me pause you and bring you over to that.
Yeah, this is good.
I don't know how often that's going to happen in this conversation. Sorry. But I'm hoping I didn't completely ruin your train of thought, and you can remember where you were headed when I interrupted you with that.
No, and I encourage all the questions, because this is really important to me, and I want others to know exactly why you and I care so much about it. So what ended up happening was, over the next year, I went to all the different denominational bodies. I went to all the different places, couldn't find the data. But I, in addition to not hearing, I heard several things happen. One, some of the traditional places that you would go to were supportive, absolutely supportive, and said, absolutely, if you find this data, if you make this data happen, we will use it. And then sometimes I would ask them, well, would you help donate? And some people would not. There were some giving consultants out there who told me, well, I don't understand. Why don't you just do a quantitative, you know, study, and, you know, I'll compare Black people to Asian people, right? So there was a real lack of understanding as well about the fact that there's a multiplicity of variables and characteristics that take place with the research, right? Around first and second generation, around ethnicity and race and gender, all of those things, right? Also, there, what we heard over and over, and this is the really painful part, was the ways in which data had been misused by white Caucasian people. And it had been misused and used to recruit larger major gifts from people of color for white communities. And so what I heard over and over was that there was a lack of trust from leaders of communities of color to want to participate in regular data collection, which is why, in part, despite a lot of efforts done by some good organizations to get people involved, there was a breakdown as to how is that data going to be used, by whom and for whom. Is this really going to help me at all?
Wow.
So just the work of trying to find the data brought up some really hard information. Mika and I sat down one day and we said, this is probably going to cost us a lot, but we need to do this. We developed a team, and I spent the next year fundraising just to be able to do this, because, again, there were lots of people that were willing to use our data. It was a whole other thing for them to be willing to do it. to do the research themselves. What we found was that it took a little bit of work to do the fundraising. So the House of Bishops, the Episcopal Church, were the first in, and then followed the Presbyterian Foundation and Thrivent. So by the end, we were able to gather most mainline denominations to support this research. And then we went ahead, and the next part was really difficult, recruiting people to be part of the study. It required a lot of safeguards. It required a lot of commitments to how this information would be used and how this was going to better the communities involved. So we went into some covenantal relationships. Then the study was published during COVID time. Amy Larimore was the writer for this. We had the researcher from the Millennial Impact Study do the qualitative research. And so now the Collective Foundation has this research available to you. What I can tell you is that what we learned over and over and over was life-changing for me, which is that the way that granting institutions, the way that donors give to leaders of color is different than it is for people that are white. Now, Blackbaud did a small study as well that showed that for granting organizations, people that lead nonprofits that are people of color have two things that happen. One, they experienced up to 25% less funding grants, as well as they experience far more ties, far more obligations, strings attached to their gifts. We saw the same thing in our research as far as churches giving to outside institutions, as well as leaders of churches looking for grants or looking for larger donations from organizations or people that were white. This was a theme that was brought up over and over. One of the things I kept on hearing over and over was, what do I have to do with my body? What happens to my body when I have to go ask for a gift? What do I have? The tears and the anger and the betrayal that I experienced in those rooms was profound. And it shaped my vocation. I no longer talk about giving just as a ministry itself. I talk about bodies constantly now, because I think that is where we need to expand our notion of what philanthropy is, because this definition of philanthropic redlining, where we see these limits, do not take into account how bodies have been seen as objects for value for years and years and years. And it's because of that that we begin to measure our ability to give to others based on impact or based on measurables that one would look at a machine or an object.
Aaron, I'm in my head, there's a lot going on. And there's a lot I want to say, but I'm hesitant in part because I haven't begun my research yet, but you have described almost to a T the preliminary questions that my mentor and I will be asking as we delve into this research and these questions. And so, again, just I'm so grateful for the work that you've already done. I'm picturing like the not just the tilling of the ground, but that to me feels like the really hard part that you and your partners have already begun to do in this. that feels like a good place. I want to say kind of a side comment, and then I want to ask you to define for us philanthropic redlining. I'm going to name your chapter in this book, but really briefly, this chapter that's going to be the conversation that, you know, kind of the remainder of the conversation that Erin and I are going to have today is her chapter in this book that she co-edited, Crisis and Care, that I mentioned. One of the things that struck me, this had a chapter by Patrick Reyes, who was introduced to. He's so fabulous, but I was introduced to him, his work. I don't know Patrick personally, but I was introduced to his work in my first quarter of my MDiv at Fuller, which happened actually in the summer of 2020. So I usually say when nothing else was going on in the world, I started my MDiv program, which was true, June of 2020. And I read Nobody Cries When They Die.
That's right. It's like,
and because I just thought, this is, you're talking about bodies. And that book does have a lot of focus on his experience in post-secondary education. And it really spoke to me because I am a mixed Hispanic and white female. And I had, it was like, I cried reading the book. Because so many of the experiences he describes at being in university and seminary were experiences that I had lived. And, you know, I was getting, of course, beginning my second master's at that point. My first one I got, I usually say when I was young and didn't know this one was coming down the pike in my almost middle age. But those, you know, I'm sitting here thinking, okay, I'm getting a master's degree. It's my second one. I did all of this when I was young, and still I can feel the very real feelings pertaining to my body that Patrick talks about in that book of his. And so I just want to name that and say that this it has a chapter by Patrick, was written, you know, between 2016 and 2020, with lots of folks contributing who are asking questions like those that you're asking, who are talking about how can we think about these things differently? You know, what about these paradigms that we have can be shifted or really even struck down? I feel like I read in some of the chapters, how can they be rebuilt in ways that make sense theologically and also sociologically and culturally and things like that? How can they really speak to our reality instead of, you know, what we've kind of said are our realities, you know, and taking back to this data that was not really actually representative. And so the whole volume is great. It's a short read if folks are interested in that. But the bodies part, I was just taken back to Patrick's work and naming some of those things of like, what, how are we seen even as BIPOC folks in, you know, these educational spaces? And what he spoke to in that book was the impact on us as people, right? Like myself as a person, my self-image, you know, these kinds of things are part of what Patrick spoke to. And I know that that's something you touched on it already, but that I think those of you who are in this world, in this research, and I soon will be too, of what we'll see with folks, these leaders, it impacts their bodies when they enter into these spaces, and the importance of that it's not just about impact and dollars. And I this will be one of those where I take more notes than I came in with, but the quote that you said at the beginning, where money intersects with bodies, we see systems of inequity. So I just wanted to name that as we go into talking a little bit more about your chapter. And it's called Philanthropic Redlining, Working Twice as Hard for Half as Much, which is what you just described. So I'm wondering though, for folks who, like I said, when I say, I'm going to research philanthropic redlining, and people look at me and they're like, you just said something that I have no idea. And I'm like, yes, and me too, until a few years ago when it was introduced to me by some BIPOC faith leaders who, you know, had to, this was their everyday reality. So first, what is it? What is philanthropic redlining? What kind of definition can help us think about this as we move forward in this second part of the conversation?
It's the way in which systems have been set up to restrict the ability to provide resources or to distribute resources or to allocate resources equitably. Similar to the redlining that was experienced with land and real estate, there is a language that says that the American dream is accessible to all, right? And yet we know with the GI Bill that took place, land was only accessible to some. And if you were provided funding, there were only some places where you were allowed to go. And if you were provided funding and you went to those places, you received a lot more strings attached. So similarly, with resources, with finances, in the philanthropic world, where giving is meant to be used, I believe, theologically, for repair of the world, to join God in that repair together as we repair our relationships to one another. This is a point of evil, frankly, where there's gatekeeping, where there is people who have a lot of power and they are worried about ensuring that the right measurables, quote unquote, right measurables are used for allocation of resources. And by being focused on this instead of on equitability, and instead of focusing on the humanity of everyone, instead of thinking about what is the cost, they diminish the ability for resources to be used broadly.
So I'm just going to interject. I'm going to have a resource list in the show notes as per the use here on the podcast. But one of those I'm going to put there is The Color of Law, which gives a really good history and background for the redlining that you just talked about that happened with real estate in the U.S. And I want to just say a small note that when the author begins this book, something that struck me was that he begins the stories that he tells in, I think it's San Francisco, if I'm not mistaken, which for me, and I was talking with my dad who was also reading it, and I'm like, oh my goodness, this was the perfect place to begin geographically, because it, again, broke kind of all of these paradigms that I had of like, oh, this is something that happened in the South, or, oh, this is, you know. So I use that to say, for me, thinking about the systems that were legal, I mean, it's called The Color of Law, right? The systems that were legal were happening in places that we might not have suspected. And at the same time, I think we can say this was kind of one of those places which let us know that this was pervasive, that this was happening like everywhere. And so it's my suspicion that as we get into philanthropic redlining and we begin to learn more about this phenomenon, that it will be similar, that we will say, what? This is happening kind of in the San Franciscos of the faith world, you know, like this is happening everywhere. Right. You know, this seems wild. So anyway, just wanted to throw that in as we continue with this.
No, I redlining as a practice of land is happening now. And it's,
yes,
Minnesota, where I live, is one of the most liberal places, as you know. It's certainly gotten a lot of attention lately. And I can tell you, in a nearby suburb, they've just last year shifted some of the zoning laws that were allowing for redlining to take place just outside of where I live. It's happening everywhere. And oftentimes there are systems that have been ingrained so long that people aren't even aware. So philanthropic redlining is happening as well. I can tell you, for example, my experience as being a grants officer and what I was taught in my master's program was that you look for measurables. You look for particular ways of what success looks like, and you fund towards success, right? This is what you're taught. But what happens if those markers of success are different than what the data is saying, right? What if success does not take into account cost and whose bodies had to be sacrificed in order to reach that success? So there's so much more that we are not taking into account when we are teaching master level program like you and I, right? And we're training people out for the world. And I think that this is why it's so pervasive. Is for example, I think I write this in the book, but I think it's a really clear one. Speaking of judicatory bodies, right? I was at a judicatory body where one parish was held up, an immigrant community, Asian immigrant community, was held up as saying, hey, by utilizing some practices, they were able to increase their giving. What we're going to do is we're going to grant to them a step-down model. This is what so many granting organizations do, right? They don't want people to become dependent, right? That word, dependent. So they step down and they say, once you meet our measurables, then, you can continue to be granted at a lower level, lower level. But what happens if those measurables don't contextually make sense? So this judicatory body said, oh, look, this Asian congregation was able to step down really well using our measurables, right? And then they looked at a Hispanic congregation that was full of undocumented workers and asked the exact same thing of them, saying, okay, here are the things that we need you to do. And we need both, of course, needing documentation, right? We need you to do X, Y, and Z. And then once we begin to see growth in that area, we'll continue to fund you at a decreased amount, not taking into account the fact that undocumented individuals, of course, aren't going to want to fill out forms, that are, of course, not going to want to be part of any type of registration, right? What looked like success here could not be used as success here. Additionally, for this Asian community, this was folks that were primarily middle class individuals, right, who knew annually what their incomes were going to be. These undocumented workers over here were folks that were more, they worked contractually, right? Week to week at best, right? They were only able to give what they had at that moment. There was no way that they were going to be able to estimate, right? How unfair, how deeply wrong to even ask them to give out of something that they didn't even know they had. That was probably my most stark example of seeing it in the church, of saying, oh, these two are exactly the same. Clearly, we can ask the same thing from this grants. So.
Yeah, that example of yours from this research that I read was so striking to me as well. I live in and work in Houston. This is a we are a community full of immigrants from all over the world.
Yeah.
We are, I think, the most international city in the country
I've heard
right
that.
now.
Yes.
And there are lots of folks who are documented and lots of folks who aren't. And as you know, as a Hispanic woman, when I read that study or that example, that case study, I even though that isn't hasn't been my situation, I immediately could begin to empathize and see how the Hispanic community, I could imagine the feelings and the response to that. But then I could also see, oh, for someone, a governing body who's unfamiliar, yeah, we look at these and say, oh, they're like similarly sized immigrant communities, maybe first gen, maybe one and a half or second, you know, all this, maybe they're in a similar geographic region, you know, blah, blah, blah. But the impact is of the ask is so different in those communities. And especially as, you know, the context of your book, the timing between 2016 and 2020.
That's right.
The fear,
it's dangerous.
The fear factor there. You know, we're sitting in September of 2024, where the debate was just on a couple of nights ago, and the question surrounding not just the rumors, but you know, we have the same presidential candidate as was president during the time, who is you know, pledging to deport immigrants. Mm-hmm. Who is, you know, using very hateful language when it comes specifically to Latino immigrants. And in this environment, you know, I think about, you know, some of the previous, you know, social work I've done and things like this. When people are living inside of fear, and I think really well-founded fear in this situation, some of these other things, like how much money am I going to give to my church? These are not on the radar for... This is not just how am I going to feed my family, but will my home still be my home next week?
That is so powerful. That is so powerful. And here's the thing. What is the church's responsibility in that moment?
Right.
And what, to take it one step further, then also what ends up happening to that congregation of scared, some are, not all. Some were scared individuals who were saying, I'm not filling something out, right? What happens to this congregation when they no longer receive the funding because they aren't upping their number of pledges, when they aren't employing the traditional right? You can't see me, podcast listeners, but I'm doing quotes here. The traditional right way of doing fundraising, right? Where they're doing contextually based fundraising, which is different than what is recommended. So of course their numbers are down, right? What happens to that leader that's told, you know, you're not following our instructions, so you're disobedient. So what does that mean for our trust in you, right? Like there's all of these layers that take place. So of course, when people are asked, hey, can you take this study for us on giving characteristics of color? There was hesitancy. There's deep distrust. And there's a lot of pain that gets brought up. Because it's also like, why in the world do I want to, why do I even want to bring all of this pain and trauma up again, right? For what good will that do? So
that's right. Yeah. And I'm also reminded, you know, I sometimes think this is what some of the fun part of being mixed is. I get to kind of look at different sides of my family, you know, how have we operated, you know, and things like that. And I think about, I'm drawn back to that Hmong word of family, you know, this is the context, right? And I think, and this isn't what we're talking about, but just something that came to my mind is I'm an imaginary body that might be in charge of the funding, might look and say, oh, this Hispanic congregation wasn't responsible with what we gave them. And it might in some worlds impact how future congregations like that one are funded. And also I'm thinking about the folks in that space. Are they receiving a word about them that is, you know, I would say kind of categorically untrue? Are they receiving a word about themselves that says, I'm not generous? You know, are they receiving a word about themselves that says, I'm not responsible? Are they receiving a word about themselves from this governing body that says something that's categorically untrue about their person? You know, I think I don't know that I've ever witnessed any of my Hispanic family asking for a tax receipt when they have given, you know, a gift in generosity. You know, I think about the times that I went to visit my grandfather and he would just randomly give me gas money. You know, my white grandma did the same thing. You know, but thankfully I was able to drive around a little bit, but you know, just thinking about the generosity, even in the neighborhoods and families, and on our Hispanic side of the family, that, you know, folks just helped each other out, whether it was in the context of the church or not, you know, and I know that there are other cultures and communities that do the same thing as well. I'm just speaking from my own context, but I just think, what if I were in that position and I had someone kind of implying at least that I had not been generous or responsible with the funding that I had had, I think that that would, I would have to wrestle with that at best, I think, and maybe at worst, it might really impact who I believed myself or my community to be. It might be formative, malformative, you know, in some of those ways. So anyway, just, you know, my imagination just kind of going wild here on some of the impact of something like that.
There's another also spoke to this wheel of impact, which is, twofold. One, it was very difficult to find individuals of color who specifically identified themselves as fundraisers. Mm. And what we heard was that there's a high burnout rate. There's also so many barriers for a person who is of color who's fundraising, because they receive less funding, because they receive grants that have those ties, that oftentimes they are let go a lot quicker from their position. One of the things that was really striking to me among the participants, and this was pointed out by Amy Larimore in particular, was that we brought in some of the best leaders who are raising money in the country. And many of them said, I don't know why we're here. We're not fundraisers. We don't raise funds. And we took a minute because obviously, you know, language and words could be, you know, like, is this some, and we did some unpacking of that. Is this because you don't use the word fundraising, or is this because, you know, do you consider yourself a stewardship leader? They didn't consider themselves necessarily good at what they do. They didn't think that they were enough, or that they had done enough. And there were a number of people who cried, who said, this was a really powerful experience just to be able to claim that space as their own. And so there's that component as well, as then who is speaking for the community and the impact that all of this systemic injustice does to their body.
Wow. Thank you so much for that, Erin. I feel like we have barely scratched the surface.
Should we do this again sometime?
I think we should. I think we should do it again sometime and record it. And I think we probably will do it a lot more and not record it, because I am going to find myself probably desperate, maybe a strong word. But for folks who have lived and breathed and moved in this space, and for what you guys have already discovered, and I will be, gosh, not just standing on your shoulders, but probably asking you to dig around with me a little bit more as we keep going.
I'm in your corner. I'm happy to support you. This is really important work.
I'm grateful, Erin. I'm so grateful. And again, I just want to say the name of this book again. This, again, it's a short read. You even say in the intro for folks who just, you know, you can read a chapter by chapter, you can skip around these things, but every essay was well worth the pages and the time to look at it. I have so many notes, so many dog ears, so many stars. And it really, I think, is good for all of us lay people who don't have a clergy or a research role in this to say, how have I thought about this? Even just in our personal call to generosity as Christians, how have I thought about this? How have I been discipled to think about this? And how might reading some of these stories impact how I think about this in the future? So, Erin, thank you again so much. Again, it's Crisis in Care, Meditations on Faith and Philanthropy, specifically today talking about philanthropic redlining. Thank you so much for being with me.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thank you.
The links for all the resources mentioned in today's episode can be found in the show notes. Music and podcast production by Seth Busetti. Be sure to give us a review on iTunes and subscribe at your favorite podcast listening app. You can also visit us at thatmakestotalsense.com.